Right, welcome back. Before we get on to the questions to the generally to the panel, I've got three questions left over from the last talk, which are going to be addressed to Peter. And I think we'll just do those, and then when we get on to the main panel discussion, I'll try and ask people, first of all, keep their questions fairly short, and also ask the answerers, please, perhaps just to answer, give one answer each, so we can get through as many questions as possible, and therefore as many discussions as possible, during the time, up to 12:30. So first of all, Mike. You've got a question to Peter left over.
Well, first of all, two further allies for Peter's position. Aristotle in the Metaphysics, who's what's called the ontological version of the law of non-contradiction. For any object X and any property P, it's not the case that X has P and X does not have P. And that's really a statement about the world.
Right.
The other ally is Penelope Maddy in her book, Second Philosophy. And she says that, at least at the level of medium-sized dry goods, the world is so structured that the laws of thought, the identity, non-contradiction, and intuitive middle, just work. So you can look at the laws of thought as generalised statements, rather akin to scientific statements. But the question is that it seems to me that some people forget that we can actually have experience about human constructs. So an argument, such as one that follows modus ponens or modus tollens, is a human construct. We can investigate how that works, that's experience. So it's the case of experience, perhaps, telling us that these particular argument forms work. They transmit truth from the premises to the conclusion. Does that seem to be a reasonable point of view?
Yes, I'm not sure it would support my position. I mean, if you...
Do you repeat the question?
Yes. mine's gone a blank. what was the question? the last bit, it's just trigger me.
We can actually have experience of human construct.
Oh, yeah, sorry, I've got it. Yeah, the question is whether. In addition to the, in my talk, I had certain things that were the other side of the line, I called it, which are just sort of not connected to the world. And Mike is saying, well, you can have experience of those as well, and sort of bring them within the fold. Is that the thought?
Between the external world and the human world, we operate in certain ways. We investigate that. We devise arguments. We can see which arguments work, which don't. And why isn't that experience as much as seeing
the... Well, I suppose what I'm saying is that the arguments that do work will work because they reflect the real world. The arguments that don't work will not have their basis in experience, and that's why they don't work. So, although you can have experience of chess or games and so on, it's the bits that work that I'm... claiming are rooted in the world. So the other stuff, the ones that don't work, I'd be inclined to put the other side of my line, I think.
Okay, now two more questions for Peter. One is actually from Jonathan, who's on the panel. You might as well use the microphone for this question.
Okay, I wasn't very convinced by your hunter-gatherers. It seemed to me that what you were actually demonstrating was much more about a priori contents of minds that they brought to experience than things they'd learned. And I imagine these three hunter-gatherers walking along, and one of them says, "There's a stag." Another one says, "There's not a stag." And they turn to the third one, who says, "I think you're both right." And they both look at him as though he's bonkers, because not because of anything they've learned about stags or not stags from experience, but because their minds are not constructed to accept the idea that it can both be and not be a stag. They don't have to put it in form of either P or not P, but that's what they bring to it, not something they've learned from counting up the occasions of stags and not stags.
Well, obviously, I can't disprove your claim, unless anyone can find the hunter-gatherer. I'm still going to stand by my position that they look at this guy askance and say, what the hell's the matter with you? But the reason is because this guy doesn't know anything about stags, not because he's got some a priori insight into the world. You know, have you ever seen a stag? An example that comes to mind is, there's an example that people cite where someone is leaning in a doorway, an open doorway, and someone says he's in the room, and someone says he's not in the room, and then someone else says, well, he's in the room and he isn't in the room. And in that example, you could say, well, yeah, I suppose you're right. But you'd have to look at the bloke standing in the doorway and see exactly where he was, not come up with an a priori thing.
The last question left over is to Nick.
Peter's told me my question should be barred. I have another question for the panel.
He was going to mention quantum mechanics, but I don't take questions on quantum mechanics.
Right, well, in that case, we now have questions for the panel. If you want to ask a question, I've already got two down, Frank and Chris, and Jean and Nick. Just put your hand up, not necessarily in between questions, but at any point, and I'll try and see who you are and write the name down. Or the description which I'm not going to see. Okay, so questions are now on to the whole panel. I'd say if you could just restrict yourselves to one answer each, unless there's something really urgent comes up, then we can get through more questions. I'm going to be a vicious chairman this time. Right, so the first question from... Well, actually, Nick, you better ask your question if you've been waiting on this.
It seems a lot of the discussion and some analysis is based on the individual. In fact, just the discussion we had there about these three hunter gatherers. And knowledge being either empirical or innate. But it seems to be that most of my knowledge comes from what other people have told me. So do you think if you analyse the empiricism debate in terms of the whole human race, the body of knowledge of the whole human race, that we might lead to different conclusions, and I'm thinking with that, of course, you've got the past to consider, you've got ideas which may be passed on from one generation to another, perhaps our biology, like birds building nests, maybe that's inherent in their biology. Do you think that if the analysis took place at the level of the whole human race, as opposed to the individual, it would lead to different conclusions in particular areas?
Who's going to take it first? Can they repeat? Can you repeat the questions? Because I'm not sure if everyone can hear. I can't.
Can I give a one-word answer?
Just one answer, not one word.
No. It would make no difference. The question is about whether there's sort of group empiricism rather than individual empiricism. Whether empiricism struggles with the group in a way it doesn't with the individual. My answer is no.
No, on my model it doesn't. On the model I put forward, I say it doesn't. It's simply because the group performs the task of objectifying what is the primary experience. And indeed, on my model, this problem of contradiction is not bivalence. Is not a problem either, because my model of concept formation is a branching path, and you can't take both branches at once. I don't think the idea of not being able to take two branches at once is an idea that needs to be particularly implanted. It seems so obvious that I can't believe we have to make it an axiom.
I think James, which was the perspective I was coming from, and I think also Reid, who was a Scottish philosopher around the time that David Hume was writing, talk about the fact that most of our knowledge comes from things that we don't experience, but that knowledge has come from something that somebody else has experienced. So we have that sort of, I suppose it's sort of a bit of an acceptance on faith, but based on the fact that we accept the source of that knowledge on some basis of expertise or something like that. But it's true that, I mean, most of our knowledge isn't from our own experience, but it is from experience. Yeah.
I'd like to have a go at answering that question that you were banned. Which means I've got to guess what it was. But I think you were going to mention quantum mechanics and
Is your switched on?
I've failed. I'm going to have a go at guessing that you were going to bring in quantum mechanics and saying that it's possible to both be and not be. And I wanted to quote Peter Gibson's limerick in answer to Berkeley. Do you remember the
tree?
That was me.
About the tree and the quad.
That was me.
The tree and the quad. Yes. Quantum. The superimposed states of the quad means the quantum mechanical god can see that the tree can both be and not be, which most of us find rather odd. Is that correct?
Yes.
Very well said.
It's my guess at what you were going to
say. Should we take a shot at that?
John, have you got something to add to that?
Hume says something about testimony and history where he says, you know, people, there's testimony about Caesar being stabbed, and how can you believe that? And it's because the custom is that no person would want to give a false testimony, and it would all reinforce the truth of that. So I think, yeah, there is a way that, you know, we can collectively come to knowledge through experience. It just has to all lead into some object of experience.
Thanks. One of the things I like about empiricism is that you start from what anybody can see, touch, or confirm for themselves. Even where you receive your knowledge at second hand, you're taking it on the basis that I could go and verify this for myself. And even when people then disagree about the interpretation of what it is that they've seen or experienced, the disagreement is about something concrete and specific, not about something airy-fairy and speculative. So, the point about a collective empiricism seems to me one of its strengths.
Right, thank you. We now come on to the next question I've got wrapped up, which is Frank.
I'd like to address Peter. I thought you made a brilliant case for deriving logic from empirical matters, from experience. But you didn't mention sceptical criticisms of empiricism, possibly because that wasn't absolutely pertinent to the case you were making, which you made very well. But to the extent that the sceptic has got a good case against the empirical, presumably that case has to be extended to logic, if you're going to derive logic from the empirical. Now, I can see a way out of that, which might be Hume's way, but it does have to make concessions to practicality. Hume was a mild an empiricist, and maybe a mild empiricist, at the same time as being a mild sceptic. I could say a little bit more about how he does that, but would you accept that in order to defend logic, if it derives from empiricism, you would have to defend empiricism against sceptical objections?
Well, scepticism comes in many forms, so I'm not...
Let's talk about the veil of perception problem.
There's a scepticism about a real external world. Is that the scepticism you're talking about? Yeah. I've been defending and I mean, someone at tea time sort of brought out the fact that I'm standing up here defending empiricism and an empirical account, but then in my paper I was defending that the fact that the real world was actually dictating the logic. And so if you open up a gap between experience and the real world, what am I going to do? And the answer is I'll just retreat to experience and run my argument again. So I'll just say that it precisely maps experience. Experience has got nothing to do with the real world, and I know anything about the real world, and logic maps experience, so I wouldn't be worried by scepticism about the real world.
Right. But then you do make yourself vulnerable to the gap between experience.
Well, no, I don't think I'm vulnerable at all. I mean, if you don't like realism, then I'll just play safe, you know, and I'm perfectly safe in talking about experiences. No one denies that you have experiences. So no, I just say logic is about experiences.
You can argue fairly strongly for the validity of logic as an a priori science, which doesn't depend upon experience.
Yeah, obviously you can switch to a completely different view, which, I mean, I've given you the Platonist and logical positivist options, but I mean, what would weaken my position is that I was claiming that logic has this sort of absolute authority that we all feel about logic, and I was suggesting that the authority comes from realism. I am a realist, and I do think that the authority comes from the real world. If I have to give up the real world and say it's just experience, my authority is undermined, because, and particularly, my experiences will be different from yours, and so we'll be on flaky ground. So I'd much rather hang on to realism, but I can have a sort of rather wishy-washy version of my theory with just experiences if you're going to challenge me.
That's fine. I think you've accepted my point.
I could comment on that. Yes, your experiences could be different. It's irrelevant when it comes to exchanging experiences, because we have to exchange those experiences in a common form, or when we share them, when we objectify them, then they become common. They become part of a common forms. And the relation between the language and the logic is something that could be explored at some other time, I think, because it's very complex. And they are, logic and language are derived from different roots and branch in different ways. Language is a multi-purpose tool. Logic tends to be a single-purpose tool. So the fact is, when you are talking about the validity of the logic, you're talking at a level above experience, on the route to objectivization, to something shared. And I share what Peter said about the irrelevance of skepticism to an empiricist. Talk of the real world is has nothing to do with it. What do you mean, real world?
Well, I suppose I'm sort of would be agreeing with Peter there, is that there is an element of irrelevance in it if we are just working on the basis of experience, and other Peter saying that the real world perhaps gives authority to that experience. I'm not sure that that's necessary. I think the only authority you need is experience, and then the objectification of that experience by the shared form of language. So I don't know that I see a problem.
That you have to justify your realism.
I'm not going down the path of realism, anti-realism on this issue. I'm just talking about.
But what we're saying is, you can give up the realism, but still tell a coherent story.
Yeah.
A combination of what I said with what Peter said, the sort of Wittgensteinian private language argument sort of thing about it all having to be, you know, to mesh together. So you've got a nice stable framework to build the logic on, built from experiences.
Yeah.
So you don't need to. You've got something that's quite authoritative without invoking reality.
Exactly. Mm.
Right. Anyone else like to speak?
On the subject of learning the laws of logic empirically. Sorry, is this still? I think in any teacher, anyone who deals with young children, and psychologists, studies the way in which their logic develops, which appears to support that individual. For instance, you'll say to a young child, stealing is wrong. Which is worse, stealing a large loaf of bread or a gold coin? They'll say the large loaf of bread, because it's bigger. So, and they're developing from experience. And the transition, which they find very difficult, is realising that when they've seen a logical connection in one instance to do with cows, that it also applies to cats and it also applies to everything else. So it's going to the P therefore Q side, which when they reach that point, there's a sort of light comes on when you realise that here is an actual truth, which is not something which you've gained from experience, the fact that this is always going to happen in every other case. So they learn it by experience with the world in the same way that you learn the language when you get the input. But then you've got a structure where something's gone beyond it, beyond experience.
It's still valid experience.
Sorry, you want the microphone?
No, I'm fine. Yeah, just add that it's still valid in experience. Yeah, it's interesting that we can have experience and deal with it logically. And I mean, all a priori knowledge is informed by experience, but we can somehow deal with empirical experience in order with reason in order to get something that is valid in experience without having experienced it. It's just, yeah, it's very strange. Kant says that there is some reality in our thinking that I think sort of makes this happen.
I would just agree with, I think, the tenor of several of the answers, that if I am having the same experiences as other people are having, I can't see what the world that those experiences reveal can be contrasted with. I can't see what the meaning would be of a real world which would somehow be at variance with or in agreement with. That it seems to be a meaningless concept.
Can I answer that?
Well,
briefly.
Well, in a sentence.
It's just that maybe lots of real worlds, because I'm quite sure that the world human beings experience, one species, is different from the world that another species, let's say a gnat or a bat or a tiger, they are different worlds. So I think there is meaning to. One can see the possibility of difference between experience and what we experience.
No problem.
Okay.
Sorry, can I just add one thing to put this in a larger frame, because it's something that worried me overnight. It didn't worry me, it came as a revelation. Anthropologists, who are sort of scientists, they see as a sort of basic opposition amongst people all over the world, that between nature and nurture, between human beings and the world as it is, that is, between empiricism, if you like, and reality, scepticism. So, and all these people have ways of reconciling these two. When I say reconciling, reconciliation is never complete. It's always a struggle. There are always forms of making these two confront and compromise. Games, rituals, religions, and among these that we use are philosophy and science. Everything we're talking about today is taking part in that human struggle to reconcile the world out there, the world of nature, the world that Levi-Strauss calls event, with the human world, which is the world of structure. And because our structures are limited, we know that. We know that what goes on in our mind has limits, but we don't know that what goes on out there has limits, and we don't know what those limits are. We have no way of knowing what those limits are, and we know that that's partly because of the limits that are in our mind. So everything we're doing is part of that much larger picture, and it will never be resolved.
Right, thank you. It'll never be resolved. We'll try and resolve the next question. Chris is next on the list, and then Jean. So, Chris.
Right, so my question is this. So if I was to ask you why you believe in electrons or X-rays, which you obviously can't directly observe, you'd have to embark on some analysis of how scientists do inferences and so on, and and then we would all accept, I think, well, with few exceptions, that these things are theory-laden, that theory is involved in building the instruments and interpreting it. Now, if I was then to say, well, I actually think that everyday language is the same. I think all our discourse is theory-laden. And you might think, now, come on now. Look, we've all been talking all the whole weekend about direct validation of our statements by our experiences. Now, I noticed that every single member of the panel wears spectacles. And if you remove the spectacles and see the world as it really is, with your direct, unaided senses, that is very different. So I actually am a blob theorist, although I've never been able to get my theory published, but I see a load of interpenetrating blobs. I don't see objects. I see things that were more elaborately described, more accurately described as being sort of gases or sort of diffuse. So when I put these spectacles on, I distort reality. So what it is, I think, is that all of us, except for the few who don't seem to wear these distorting devices, that our experiences are manufactured. And what we actually use rational ideas and theories to manipulate our experiences, and we move these things around so that we get some kind of satisfactory story. So my point is, and do you agree with me, addressed to all of you, that you can't disentangle experience, empiricism in the sense that things arising from experience, but with experiments and with idea, with theoretical ideas. In other words, our experiences of the everyday world are theory laden.
Right, who'd like to start?
Absolutely.
I don't think they're necessarily theory laden, because I think the word theory should be reserved for more formal structures. They're structure laden, they're tool. I go back to the idea of the starter kit. Our task should be, philosophically speaking, maybe scientifically speaking as well, to identify the starter kit. One addition to that toolbox, which again occurred to me since yesterday, is the big word if, I-F, the hypothetical, which, as far as we know, animals don't have, but it's a sort of memory, reversal of memory. Memory goes backwards, if goes forwards, but it relies on memory to work. And the if is an enormous human tool that we use all the time, which is why I tried to make it underlie Peter's knot. I want it to intrude everywhere. Imagination, possibility, art, fiction, scientific hypotheses, even theories are big ifs. So let's go for the starter kit and work on it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, from your comments, I think, you know, that we infer from the senses all the time, and so we're always constructing some kind of framework on which to drive our experience. So, yeah, there's always some kind of thoughtful framework involved in the experience.
Okay. I thought there were two strands in the way you put the question. One was that, in a sense, we cannot help but describe our experience in terms which imply some sort of construction of it, but also you were using terms like manipulate and so on, which suggested somehow that we could, if we only tried hard enough, divorce ourselves from these constructions and tell it right, like it really is. And I'm going with the first one. We can't help it. And I'm abandoning or rejecting the second, that we could. There is some sort of sense in which we could see it or experience or tell it like it really is without experiencing it as something. I don't think we can.
Can I have Barbara? You've got something.
Your point is really that you've already constructed reality and then you're looking for some kind of support for that in the theory. And I feel that there's a big danger of this in a lot of scientific work, where the motto could be seek and you shall find, because you're going to find what it is you were looking for, because you've already constructed a reality in which that's what you expect to find. And it reminds me of the story of the man who was looking for a gold sovereign that he dropped in the light of this lamppost. And his friend said, "I thought you dropped it on the other side of the street." And he said, "Yeah, I did, but the light's better over here."
Can I just add one little thing?
Peter, have you got something?
I just want to say very quickly, was that there is this notion in Quine, isn't there, in determinacy of translation. We're talking about objectifying these things through language, but of course, actually, there are sometimes sort of areas where there's a not a cultural fit, if you like, yeah? And that sometimes needs to be worked on, so we can be appearing to agree or disagree, and actually, in essence, that might not necessarily be the case, or we might be talking about different things, in fact, but using the same terms. So that's an area. Yes, like democracy.
When Tim Williamson came to speak to us at a weekend, he described himself as a Rottweiler realist, and I thought, yes, so that's me. So your example of the glasses, I'm not quite sure what you were saying about the glasses, but the implication was sort of, I mean, I see you as blurred and then I see you as more clear, and you seem to be saying that sort of my seeing you through the glasses is more theory laden because I've got glasses or something, is it? I mean, my robust... Was it not? Sorry, which way round is it? Which one's more theory-laden, that or that?
What I'm saying is that everything you're experiencing has been mediated by a theory of optics that goes back to Galileo. I didn't actually say it, but I'm implying there's a huge amount of technical, mathematical and physical theory goes into the design of these so that it manufactures the experience to be as you think it ought to be, not as it is.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, my Rottweiler realism takes it that I'm looking at you, and there is a way you are, which is completely independent of how I see you. I take for granted that I see you much better with my glasses than without. That's why I wear the glasses. I mean, I take it for example you have a certain number of hairs in your eyebrow, and I can't from here, if you would allow me to come and... there's an answer there. And I just think, these are very good glasses, but they're not perfect. Maybe they slightly distort you. But I just think this general notion of theory-laden is wildly overrated in philosophy. I mean, it's obviously true. You have to concede it, because language is low with all sorts of things, but I just think we just say things about the world that is blatantly true, and if you don't know that they're true, you can't speak English, is sort of my response. Obviously more complicated things, you know, and you start talking about quantum mechanics or something and heaps of theory, but you know, talking about this room, I just don't see it as being very theory laden at all. It's just we've got very good language that pretty precisely pick stuff out.
The point is that our knowledge can't be just coming from experience, because we manipulate the experience using knowledge.
Well, I mean, obviously you see things and you see things as something. So I catch a glimpse of you in the distance. I mean, obviously something clicks, human being. And I bring all my human being understanding to bear on what I'm saying. You then turn out to be a tailor's dummy or something, and I, you know, think, no, I got it wrong. So obviously you bring stuff like that. That's undeniable. But it doesn't, to me, alter... You know, the reality, I mean, the fact is you are a human being, so I'm doing very well when I bring this theory to bear, you know.
Right, so we go on with the next question. It's, well, my theory-laden interpretation of this blob says that it's Jean, and after that it'll be Anne.
Okay. I used to be this is directed particularly at Peter Gibson and logic, but maybe more widely. I'm sort of tending to think about knowledge coming empirically. I've always sort of thought that. But then I read Ian McGilchrist, The Master and His Emissary, last year. And I was wondering if you'd read it.
Sorry,
he's actually speaking in April here, in fact. Because he has a lot of information about the brain and about how one half of the brain is very good at constructing a coherent story if the facts are recalcitrant. And he has examples where the right brain is disabled and the left brain will do some extraordinary things, which if you've read the book, you will know. And he accumulates enough evidence that I thought, you know, a lot of my thinking really does depend on my brain structure. And I just have to take note of that as a kind of caveat to trusting my all my what comes in. So I was just thinking that possibly the logic is more innate than you thought. I'm just asking you, Jim.
Well, yes, I mean, there's a book by a chap called Robert Hannah who defends the idea that we have an innate, evolved logic mechanism, you know, that we're sort of Chomsky style born with and that develops in our brain. And that would be a kind of hardwired logic, you know, for descendants of hunter-gatherers. That's an interesting variant on my theory. It wouldn't conflict with my theory, because I wouldn't say there were cases of a lot of innate ideas. It's more like innate tools or innate mechanisms or something. But I think that would fit in with the story quite well. You know, that they were actually hardwired into the brain as a result. But I would just defend the idea that it tracks back to past experiences and, you know, lots of dead creatures that didn't get the logic right. You know.
With reference to that and Peter, apparently, talking about the brain and actually empirical studies on the brain, Einstein's brain was actually preserved and located, and it turns out it's a very odd shape, and the frontal lobe is very, very, the part that deals with abstractions and so on is very much larger than is normal. Possible that could explain why his brain works in a certain way, but I was wondering why you didn't consider the evolutionary angle of the lizard, for instance. Not that they're learning from experience about what might happen to them, but simply because the ones that got it right survived. So it's not that they ever made any logical distinction. It's merely that the ones that made the wrong one died out.
I mean, I wouldn't disagree with that. I just think that would be a more complicated story than the one I told, obviously. But I could still fit what you said into my basic theory that it's the experience that is at the root of the thing.
But it could be said that that is a modern way of talking about innate ideas.
Yes. Well, that's why I slipped in that I don't think it is innate ideas, but it's innate ideas. Mechanisms. It's more like birds building nests. Yeah. Our ability to do, you know, a small child's ability to do logic is more like a bird building a nest than it is like a child knowing something, you know.
I mean, I tried to make this point yesterday when I referred to the archaeology of concepts. Such as nativism. So nativism shares the archaeology of rationalism, but in that instance you're not talking about the platonic version, which is actually what is the real rationalist position, and that's the idea, I think, of there being fully formed ideas, concepts that we're born with. So I think if you're talking about the brain structure, I think that's a physical organ, that's a tool that we've evolved for organising how we deal with experience.
Can I just come back, because you mentioned about language virtually conditioning the way we think earlier in the question, and I'd like to just repeat this. I think that to use the word innate ideas is just an old-fashioned way of talking about what Chomsky would say is being hardwired in. It's actually got nothing to do with ideas. So it's the fact that you're using the language, which almost commits you into having concepts in your head or having ideas or knowledge in your head, that it isn't, because under Chomsky's system, the child hasn't got any ideas at all about grammar. It's just that the brain is constructed in that way that it handles the data like that.
But I don't think that's what Plato and Descartes meant.
I don't think
that's what Plato and Descartes meant.
No, it wasn't what they meant.
Can I jump in on that quickly?
Well, just a minute. I've just had the panel. I'll come to you. I've got you down. Anyone else like to say?
No problem at all with the suggestion that the way I think is due to my having a the sort of brain I've got, but I think there's a fallacy which is akin to the ad hominem fallacy. The provenance of my thinking, I can discuss my thoughts and my experiences without either regarding them as more or less valid because of the kind of brain I think them with.
Okay. Now we come to Anne's question, and the next on my list is Mike.
In his book, The Anatomy of Thought, Ian Glynn suggests that as long as we're all confused in the same way, we can go on talking intelligibly to each other without ever becoming aware of the confusion. Mm. And I just wonder whether there's something of that in what's taking place this weekend. we have been talking, since empiricism is what we're tackling, we have all been talking about experience as if we all knew what we were talking about and we were all talking about the same thing. And I suspect neither of those things might be true. And if they're not true, then I'm not looking for a theory of experience, because I don't think we've got one. By that I mean I don't think the human race has yet got one. We might have one one day, but we haven't now. But we have got some competing hypotheses as to what it is. And if the speakers and the questioners, all of us, if we had started our contributions by saying, okay, I am my hypothesis as to what experience is blah, and from that it follows blah, and somebody else had said, well, my hypothesis as to what experience is blah, you see, we would, I think, it would have think of emerged, as it hasn't maybe, that there are actually competing hypotheses as to what experience actually is. So my question is, putting it in terms of my favourite hypothesis as to what experience is, and nobody will like it, I don't think, but I think experience, the best hypothesis we've got so far, it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis, it's that which is inputted into a functioning nervous system, which alters the state of that system. That's experience. And it, for me. And that takes account of all the recent, I've said here, revelations, I don't think they're revelations, but all the increasing evidence, let's say, from neuroscience that most of our experience is totally unconscious. People still think in terms of experience as being conscious stuff. And it's not, I don't think that is going to last. It's just not possible for that to last in terms of the work that's going on in the moment. And secondly, if you say that it is that which is inputted to a functioning nervous system which alters the state of that system, if that's your hypothesis, then that is not using language such as the language of person or me or self or all that sort of stuff, which is itself, you know, theoretically still contested. It's trying to use language which is, you know, language of systems and nervous systems and functioning, which is much less contested. And so my question is, do you not think that we perhaps all ought to have, and if we don't run this weekend, perhaps we ought to in future, you know, declare, and when we're having these conversations, what our hypothesis is as to what experience is, and therefore not bother from that.
Right, thank you. Lots of stuff in that question. Jonathan wants to start.
Just your first starting point, if we're all confused in the same way, this seems to me, going back to this question of the real world, if we're all confused in the same way, we can only know, the whole concept of being confused is only if there's a clear or correct version to be confused about. And if we're all confused in the same, if we all say the same, and don't have any contradictions or whatnot, there's no sense in which we can be confused or know that we're confused. Further, if we've all been asked to state what our hypothesis of experience would be, I'd certainly be sitting here dumbfast because I have no hypothesis whatever about experience. It seems to me one of the great points about experience as I experience it that I don't have to hypothesize it at all, it's happening. And thirdly, I found your definition of experience didn't really seem to differentiate it from a large double scotch or a blow on the head.
I think experience is a creation of the understanding. I don't know about unconscious or not. As far as experiencing reality with it, I think reality is experienced in the relation of things and the order of nature and how that reveals being or permanence, and that's sort of what our experience is based on, I could say.
I mean, I have no theory of experience at all, and I actually can't think what a theory of experience would look like. I'm not sure that I can't make sense of the notion of a theory of experience. I certainly agree with Jonathan, you know, it's sort of, you're just sort of stuck with it, you know, and I thought his point about the large scotch did seem to fit your definition. That would certainly affect your nervous system. a disease, you know, having the flu would, I'm not going to disagree with you. I certainly agree strongly with you that if you're an empiricist, you've got to take into account non-conscious experience, and non-conscious experience is increasingly massive, as we realise. So, I mean, I'm training myself to think of myself as sort of 2% conscious, and 98% of my life is something else going on in the background, and that's, but as an empiricist, that would be part of what's in my story, you know.
I think the question reveals the confusion. The idea that experience is something is an incredibly confused question. I said at the beginning that there's a difference between raw experience, I have to put the word experience there in inverted commas, raw somethings, or indeed the changes in the nervous system that Anne talks about, and data. And the first problem that Sellers reveals and that we have to tackle is how we turn that raw stuff, those raw changes, into data, which then some people, according to some of the definitions we've had so far, are talking about data, they're not talking about the raw changes. How we change from one to the other is the most fundamental problem of both perception and philosophy of experience, of empiricism. And that reveals the confusion. Yes?
Are you talking about the binding problem there?
Sorry?
Are you talking about the binding problem?
I've never been clear about the binding problem.
Sorry, it's quite important.
James's theory of continuous transition is an attempt to arrive at an explanation of experience, because he's talking about the situation of being in the world subjected to continuous change and how that change fits with previous and future experiences, and how you weave a narrative to make a conjunctive account of that process. So I think that's how he would like to clarify that. It's just a bombardment, plus all your knowledge that you apply to sorting out and establishing how you understand that bombardment. You don't need to make
that. Do you want Barbara?
Yes, I think your suggestion is that it would be more methodical if we all actually stated, first of all, what we understand about how we understand experience before embarking on the rest of the talk. This reminds me of when I look in gardening books for what I should be doing in the garden. It always tells me what I should have done last month or the month before. And I'm asking, can I get a book that tells me, actually, what do I do first? Not what I should have done before, because it seems like it's very hard to get started on any topic before, because you have to define the terms that you're using
I wasn't suggesting you can define it.
Well, not define it, but, you know, even say where it comes from or its nature.
Just say something loosely about what you're taking it to be. You can't have a definition until you've got a theory, obviously.
Mm.
And we haven't got a theory. But you can say something about, well, I'm taking experience to be this or that. And none of us have done it. I'm talking about it, all of you lot, and all of us. None of us have done it.
Well, thanks. I've still got 3 people on my list and 3 minutes. The next one on the list is Mike.
Yeah, I kind of followed the previous questions because I thought I had detected a kind of unity on the panel, but the previous questions revealed that I possibly was wrong. So, pardon me for question being slightly more complex than anticipated. I thought there was an underlying theme that the proper answer to skeptic is the fact that we are not passive observers of the world, but active participants in it. That doesn't quite seem to fit with all of the answers we've been given to previous questions. So my first part is, would you agree with the statement that that is the proper answer to the skeptic, or is that answer necessary? But my more fundamental issue is, does the panel think that being an active participant in the world is the necessary condition for understanding the world?
Could I answer that first?
Is being an active participant in the world a necessary condition for understanding the world? Or is an observer, pure observer, can also allow the proper understanding of the world?
I think the thing about continuous transition that James is trying to put across, which was the position that I was presenting, is that you are in the world and you are a part of that, so you are an experience within the sequence of experiences that you're experiencing. Yeah, I need to clarify that a little bit more, but I'm about to experience missing my train, so I have to get it out and go. So this has been a really, really enjoyable weekend, but I must leave you, so I'll just walk out quietly.
Right. It's very interesting that we're now about to experience absence. Contradiction in terms, according to some people. I would say that experience is an active process, and therefore the answer to your second question is yes.
I think it's an interesting question. It's just a sort of thought experiment, really. I think to understand the world, yes, you have to be involved in it because you have to sort of, you know, muck around in it, but not in the deep way that your question seems to imply, that there's a kind of sort of fundamental, you know, sort of connection between understanding and involvement. I don't, some hypothetical being that just observes the world through a window and sort of says what's going on here would seem to do quite well, but you know, but you want to get through the window and you want to get stuck in to find out.
I would say yes on both of those, and you know, experience means having, or observing means having an intention towards some object, and eventually, you know, you move in that direction.
Thanks. I think your first question was, what's your answer to a skeptic? And I think it's pretty well the same as Hume's. You just try and live on that basis, and you know, and I'll live on the basis that these are speculative hypotheses that we go on assuming we've got something to work on. And I think the point about active participation is, you can call observation a form of participation which is intentional. And I think the crux is that the chief purpose of understanding the world is to change it. If you don't have that, you're just...
Last word, Barbara?
Well, I can't say yes or no, because I can't remember if the questions were phrased in the positive or the negative, so no, I'm right. But I would agree that you cannot be an objective observer. Knowledge is subjective because it's part of the person who's observing. It's their knowledge.
Now, just on the first question, I would just say, actually, personally, I don't think there is an answer to the skeptic.
Doesn't need to be.
It doesn't bother me.
On that note, we've come to the end of. I'm sorry for the two people, Bill and Ivor, that I've got down here, but you can ask the questions in the car. Do you want to?
I would just like to thank the speakers for giving us a fantastic time. Yes. I think it's been a great weekend.
Yes.
And for future reference, can you please let us on the committee know what topics you'd like to see for future weekends? That would be good. So that we can continue in the great tradition. Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Shall we tap each other?
Finally, can I just thank the person who put it all together?
You've done that.
Probably, you do it again.